R.I.P. Shanna Plan. Obviously, I've been thinking about this a lot the last few days. Reflecting, thinking, texting, calling, asking, trying to get the feel around what exactly was going to happen with the Leafs front office. But also looking back on what was. And Brendan Shanahan, as MLSE has announced, will not be renewing Brendan Shanahan's contract. He spent 11 seasons here, famously, 11 years. And we will hear from Keith Pelley today at 1 o'clock. It's going to air on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. You'll be able to, you'll find it very easily on Sportsnet. Go to .ca, you go to the TV, you listen to the radio, we'll have it. It's Canada's biggest team, and it's a massive day. So, I think when this stuff happens, we pivot immediately to, what's next, which is the right thing to do. But I'm a little curious, like, how much time, what I want to hear today from Keith Pelley is, like, how much time did they already spend looking at potential options for what the future could be? Because if you recall, last year, Brendan Shanahan's job was very much in doubt. He had 1 year left on the contract. He is very popular with certain people on that board. He's certainly very popular with Larry Tannenbaum. He did a lot of good here that I don't think gets seen by everyone. Like, if you listen to Kipper and Bourne yesterday, Kipper talked about the Alumni Association. And you think about things like Legends Row. Man, the Leafs and many, it would shock you how many organizations are just not great with their former players. And in Toronto's, they roll out the red carpet for their guys now. And that's a Brendan Shanahan thing. And that matters. That really does. Because this team doesn't have a laundry list of former players. There's a lot of that were loved, but that were always like around the team and in the arena and walking into the suites and wearing a jacket and making sure that they were coming in and in a concourse. Like, that's a good thing to have. It's good to be connected to your history. And I watched Dave Tiger Williams and Daryl Sittler speak on this once at a dinner, and the two of them getting emotional talking about their disconnect with the franchise and the things that Shanahan did to make them feel important and a part of it again. And I am grateful for that. Like, I am, genuinely. I'm not a former player. I didn't benefit anything of this, but I care about the history of this franchise, and Brendan Shanahan really understood that as well. As a guy who grew up here, and as a former player, he cared about those things. It was good. The culture when he got here was terrible. It was non-existent. And it was GM after GM and failed project after failed project. And there was bluster. There was all kinds of different things that did not work out in the city. This is not a winning hockey town. It hasn't been since the 60s, since there were six teams. And I think that he came in with the right idea. I really do. If you recall, if you can go back to those times when Brendan Shanahan did come over and the Shanahan plan was laid out, he convinced this organization, the ownership group, to rebuild, which was an uncomfortable proposition given all the money you can make if you just make the playoffs. And year after year after year, that was basically the formula. There was no rebuilds here. That was non-existent. Fans were clamoring for it. They were dying for it. They needed it. They wanted something refreshing and they wanted something new. And unfortunately for Brendan Shanahan, he didn't win, and now it's the same thing. He leaves with the organization in a better place in a lot of different ways, but ultimately, it's the same feeling upon his exit as when he entered, which is the vast majority of the base understanding it was time for a new vision, it was time for something, a new set of eyes to look at what is a problem, what has become a problem. And amongst all those good things, right? Like, again, deciding to draft and develop, deciding to be patient when this market has been knee-jerk. It has been. Honestly, I think that one of the legacies that's happened recently is that instead of being knee-jerk, because Toronto was so knee-jerk for so many years, that it became completely the opposite, where these runways became excruciatingly long. Like, to me, yeah, this probably ran its course a couple of years ago. There was the weirdness with Dubas in terms of like what seemingly was a power struggle, and the team got caught with their pants down trying to choose one of these two guys. But it hasn't been working for a while. And I think that the thing that he will be criticized the most for is the thing that he was one of the primary things he was brought in to do for me anyways. Again, because there was the rebuild. There was the, hey, let's try to get rid of the ghosts. Famously, like, they wanted to take that pressure off the players. Hey, they weren't around since 1967, so why should they wear that pressure like a millstone around their necks? They brought in a new coach. They brought in a new GM. It was supposed to be to get rid of blue and white disease, that mediocrity was not going to be good enough, that being just good was not good enough, and they weren't even good. So he at least made them a better version of what they were before. So it was rebuild and develop a culture that was bigger than the individual, that was bigger than just the player in the city. But then there was the Dubas infatuation. There was we can and we will. There was capitulating on big contracts to young stars that had accomplished a lot from a point standpoint, but not from a winning standpoint. The bet on talent over and over and over again, to the point where it became very clear that the high-end talent was playing by different rules than everybody else in the organization. And that became the culture. And then it breeded this stubbornness of never, I don't know if it was stubbornness or fear or a combination of both, but it festered. It festered year over year over year. And instead of making sure that something was looked at in a very serious way or that other options were explored, it always became, well, you don't want to not bet on talent. And it became this binary thing like, well, are you for losing high-end talent in a sport that is hard to lose high-end talent? Or sorry, that is hard to gain it? And by the end, it kind of got ugly. They had built so much protection, so much of a bubble around the players that we got to a spot that when the bubble burst, you're going to lose one of the best players in the NHL for likely nothing. The odds seem to be that way at this point. So it's a complicated legacy. My guess is that they don't put someone in his position this year. Maybe they explore that over the coming season. Again, I would be very curious to know what kind of back channeling happens in a season like this, where a guy is on the final year of his deal, how much the organization was preparing for this outcome. But yeah, complicated legacy. It was kind of ugly when he got here. It's a little less ugly when he leaves, but it was time for a change. Blue Jays won yesterday. That was nice. They swept. They got above 500. I wonder if there's a bit of a... I know it's early. I know it's really stupid to be standings watching at this point, but my God, it felt really good to get over 500, even though it is May. Dan Shulman, the voice of the Blue Jays, joins me now. What's up, Dan? How are we doing?
We're doing great. I'm all in on being over 500 in the psychological boost and all that. And
okay.
You know, that was a game they should have won, looked like they were going to lose, came back, looked like they were going to lose, yep. And then won. So, you know, a lot of emotions in the last three innings of that game, obviously. But, you know, sweeping San Diego. And just when you count this team out, they surprise you, right? So it's the vibes are good right now.
And I was watching yesterday, and when Hoffman gave up that home run, I'm not a big like scream at the TV guy. I think I used to be when I was younger, but I don't do it. I just watch so many games. I sit there mostly in silence, or if I'm with a friend or whatever. I did the scream when Hoffman gave up that home run. I yell. I was like, "Are you bleeping kidding me? Like, I cannot. This team 500. What is it about this team?" So I'm glad that you kind of buy that, because yeah, this has been the cycle, right? Get right up to 500 and then drop a couple of games. Get right up to 500 and then drop a couple of games. Even though it is May, I just have to think for them as a group that I'll just say what I see and you can tell me if you feel the same. They look a little bit more confident right now. The lineup feels deeper, which I got to get into a couple of those things individually in a second here. But the way that they're playing and the way that they just look from a body language standpoint is actually kind of telling me that this is a team that might roll this into a little bit more than just being a 500 struggle team.
Yeah, I hope so. And you never know, right? Baseball will trick us more than any other sport, I think, both positively and negatively. But, you know, to a man in there, they'll tell you there's a different feeling than there was the last couple of years. Now, the last couple of years, they didn't look you in the eyes and say, we had no chance to come back in that game. Like, they didn't say that in the moment, but now they're saying there's a different feeling than there was the last couple of years. And as you say, we'll get into the individuals, but, you know, Dalton Varsho's hit 7 home runs in 16 games or whatever it is, plus the triple yesterday, which was maybe the big one, you know, one of the biggest hits of the game. We could spend 15 minutes talking about Addison Barger, probably. To what degree it is real and how high the ceiling is, that stuff's TBD. But boy, has he made a difference in the lineup. And Nathan Lucas has been a big, big part of this, you know, and you got to like his story. Turning 31 soon, waited forever for an opportunity. You can look and say, well, Vlad's doing well, but there's definitely more. Bobichet's doing well, but there might be a little bit more. Santander, you know, had a couple of moments, but now he's out again, and he clearly hasn't been the best version of himself. And the crazy thing is, they're 5th in the major leagues in runs scored in the month of May. 5th out of 30. I think the perception still is, hey, the pitching's really good and the hitting's really bad. And right now the hitting's quite good over the last few weeks, and the pitching's been a little bit more up and down, although the bullpen looks, in general, looks very, very good. I think the vibe around them has changed, because even if they're down, like a month ago, if they were down 2-0 in the second, a lot of us thought it was over, right? For the most part.
Because it was.
Yesterday was their 13th come from behind win this year. They had 12 all of last year. It's a deeper lineup right now. You know, you can dream and say, hey, if they all get going, and rarely does a team get everybody going, but this to me looks a little bit more real, a little bit more sustainable than anything we've seen the last couple of years.
So there's a few things for me to that. One is, because they are coming back in baseball games, there's a feeling of, hey, maybe they're a little bit more clutch. Maybe they're a little better in some of these tough situations, whereas obviously the last couple of seasons, one of the prevailing storylines was runners in scoring position and home runs. Mm-hmm. And so when you come back in these games, I think that you inspire people a little bit more. You're right. I always say baseball is the sport that makes you look stupid all the time for having opinions, because the season's so long that it's like, okay, this week your take might look decent. Next week you look like an absolute moron for trying to opine on something with 162 games. But ultimately, just having done this so far, the hitting component for a month that you just mentioned is such a refreshing feeling from what they have done the last couple of years. Because it wasn't just 2-0 a month ago. It was 2-0 the year before, then the year before that. So the fact that the lineup feels longer, to me, is probably the most compelling reason that you think things are going to be different. And then you hone in on stuff like you mentioned the Barger part, right? Yeah, I don't know for sure. It's really intriguing. He's obviously got all the tools. People have gone over it. It's awesome. The Lucas thing, I'm like, man, he's doing sort of what we wanted Alan Roden to do, right? Mm-hmm. Play that corner outfield spot, be a decent base runner, hit for some power. What, he's got an OPS over 800 right now, if I'm right? Like, I'm pretty sure he does.
Around there, yeah. He might have, I think he dipped below and then might have gone back over again, but he's just got a high floor. He's a good
right.
player. Like, play him left, center, right. Yeah, he can. He's hit 4 home runs, which is a bit of a surprise. He makes contact. He takes walks. He's a capable outfielder in all 3 spots. He's got decent speed. And Buck and I use this kind of in a silly way, like he's a grown up, right? He knows what he's supposed to do. He's not nervous. He's not trying to be more than he is. He's a big boy. He's turning 31. He's got a couple of kids. He's been at this a long time. He was in the minor leagues a long time. And, you know, quite frankly, had he been given more of an opportunity the last couple of years, I think this is who we would have seen. And I get that he profiles more as a 4th outfielder type, like, but, you know, the crazy thing is they faced a right-handed starting pitcher. I think tonight will be the 14th or 15th game in a row or something. And he's in there almost every day. But, like, if you're sitting in front of your TV and we go to break and I say, coming up for the Blue Jays, Lucas, Clement, and Heinemann, you're feeling okay about that. Whereas, you know, like if I had said that to you in February, there's going to be a big spot and those guys are coming up, you would have gone, oh man. But now, like, everybody's chipping in. Heinemann's chipping in. Clement's chipping in. Class A is chipping in a little bit when he's been given opportunities. And again, who knows if this is sustainable, but you know, the the edges of the rod, they're more than edges now. Everybody is doing their part. They're getting a lot out of the 26 guys on the roster right now. And in a year where, to me, everybody looks similar, like, is Kansas City better than Minnesota? Is Houston better than Texas? Is Toronto better than Boston? Like, it's all the same. You know what I mean? So it's a very fine line between winning and losing games this year. And right now, you know, these are the kinds of guys who are helping them win games.
Yeah, I think that those guys are great. And Lucas has been phenomenal in terms of what the expectation was. Barger is inspiring hope of, hey, maybe you actually have a young player who is going to be more than just the wins above replacement type, or the guy that we have to question the sustainability of. To me, the big piece of this, though, is what you mentioned at the beginning, which is what we're seeing from Varsho and Kirk. Those two guys, when we're talking about what feels sustainable to me, Varsho striking out or getting an extra base hit, it kind of does. It kind of does. I love his power, and this to me looks more like the guy that was promised in the trade, not the guy that you had to say, hey, it's about the defense, it's about the defense. He looks phenomenal. And then with Kirk, that you want to talk about process. I feel like if you were going to ask me, hey, JD, whose at bats do you like the most every game? It would be the easiest answer. It would just be Kirk. I would go, yeah, it's Kirk. He's got the best at bats on the team. Like, maybe Vladdy too, but it's Kirk. He's been the best guy at the plate consistently this year. Maybe he runs down over the course of the season. I think you and I spoke about the potential for the workload going into the year and his ambitions versus what the reality might be. But having those two guys in the middle in what is a watered down American league, that feels like the most important part of what this stretch has been to me. And I wonder if you feel the same.
Yeah, I feel both of those are sustainable. So let's start with Varsho, who's hitting .215 and his strikeouts are driving him nuts. Last year, Varsho, and I'm looking at it, last year, Varsho hit .214. The year before, he hit .220. And with Arizona, when he hit 27 homers, he hit .235. Dalton Varsho is not a .280 hitter. I'm not overly concerned if he hits .214 or .234. But if he can hit 27 homers instead of 18 and hit the ball to the opposite field and hit doubles, like, the extra base potential for him is significant. You don't have to watch much to see. There's a lot of power. There's a lot of strength in that guy. He's got 14 hits. 11 of them are for extra base hits. Again, we don't want to get too carried away. It's still a relatively small sample. He's played 17 games this year, but 11 extra base hits in 17 games is phenomenal. It's not sustainable probably, but it's phenomenal. I'm okay if the average is low with the defense and the power, because you know what? They got a lot of guys who can make contact and, you know, hit for a decent average and single, single, single. They need somebody who's going to hit the ball off the wall and hit the ball over the wall, and he can do that. Kirk is one of the other guys, although there's been a little bit more power. You know, it meant, if I asked you to remember 10 moments from yesterday's game, nobody would probably pick out Alejandro Kirk's at bat. It didn't factor into the scoring. But again, he got in the hole 0-2 against a really good pitcher, Robert Suarez, who has 15 saves for San Diego, and he lines the ball to left field. Like, he doesn't doink it, he lines it. And he can foul off pitches and cover the plate and get two strike hits with just about anybody in baseball. And as you said, hopefully he doesn't wear down. He's playing more than he's ever played. He's playing 75% of the time. But his at-bats have been great the last, I don't know, whatever it is, 4 weeks or something like that. He's hitting like .350 in May. Again, not sustainable. But we've seen a couple of different levels of Alejandro Kirk offensively. We've seen Silver Slugger Alejandro Kirk. And Silver Slugger Alejandro Kirk isn't going to hit like 2024 Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but can he be a .280 hitter, hit 8 or 10 homers, .780 OPS? Possible. And that's big. Whether he's hitting five or six, wherever he is, that lengthens the lineup. Like, if you're 6-7-8 on a given day, I'm just making it up, is, you know, Kirk, Barger, Lucas, or something like that. Those guys are positives right now. They are better than the 6-7-8 guys that most other teams are rolling out there right now. So this is all great. Again, you need, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like, you need those guys really humming along too. But there are some really positive signs. I know there are a lot of people who are just hating on the offense and hating on the offseason and all that kind of stuff. But over the last 23 days, they've been one of the five or six best offensive teams in baseball. Maybe that settles, but can they be in the 10 to 15 range? Can they be a slightly above average offensive team? I think that looks plausible.
Yes, that's it for me. Is I don't expect them to be a top five offense in baseball. And I think if that's the bar, then yeah, they're not going to jump over it. It's awesome that they're hot, but to your point about the Varsho thing, yeah. Are there going to be times where there's a runner on third with one out and he's up and he strikes out that you're going to go, ugh. But as long as that power number goes up, this team is starving for it. Before May, they were sitting there like in the 28th in home runs. I remember I had Curtis Granderson on and we were chatting about it and he was looking at the stats live. And this was like, I don't know, 3 weeks ago. And he's going, I can hear him it in his voice as he's realizing how bad the Jays power numbers have been year over year. And he's like, oh yeah, you got to do better than this. I'm like, yeah, man. And so Varsho, the fact that he's doing this, I think was a big part of the play as to why they traded for him, that they thought that there was more power in the bat and we didn't see all of it. There was always the talk of like the lefties power alley. And it didn't really feel like a huge advantage for him at the Rogers Center. Now it kind of does. He's hitting for power, and it really does change the dynamic. I know I don't need you to have anybody tell you anything about Dalton Varsho. I know you're a huge fan. I know he's your guy. But, yeah, he's really – he and Kirk have impressed me lately. And while it might be a hotter version of what they ultimately end up being, to me the most encouraging thing from this entire month, outside of, again, the bullpen and Yariel and the things that do feel like you can kind of rely on them, is those two guys. Now, here's the other part. I'm going to do a couple of things I'm not as optimistic about with you. This will all be sunshine and rainbows. But the other part is something else you said, which is the division. I'm not watching as much out-of-market baseball as I have been because it's been playoffs. But I still follow the league fairly closely. And on any given night, you'll throw on, you know, you can pick a team in the American League. You can throw it out there and tell me. I don't think there's anybody that's all that good. The Yankees are fine. The Detroit Tigers, I think, are the best team in the American League. Like, who's good? Who's good in the American League this year? This might be it, really, truly. I'm not trying to do just recency bias here. This might be the worst American League in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's not great. And conversely, it's who's terrible. There aren't that many terrible teams. Like, White Sox are terrible. Baltimore is playing terribly right now. They might get better. They might turn it on, but let's put them into the we don't have to worry about them right now category. The Angels, of all teams, are hotter than anybody and a game under 500. The Angels.
Yes, but I also think they are terrible. Their bullpen is so bad.
And, you know, one of the things I think people in baseball rely on is at some point the Angels are going to angel, right? It's going to happen. Yes. So, but they're playing very well. Right. The A's are going the other way. Nice story early, very soft schedule early, which people don't pay enough attention to, like in April when that kind of stuff really matters. They've now lost nine in a row. But, yeah, there aren't as many great teams in the American League. Like, you know, most of the really powerful teams to me, I think, are over in the National League. I don't look at it as the division that much. I look at it league-wide because I'm not saying concede the division to the Yankees. But if you concede the division to the Yankees, then the division doesn't matter. Then you're just looking at, can they be one of the three best non-division winners? So, like, it may sound silly, but, you know, a series against the Twins coming up or a series against the Rangers next week, these may be super important series that ultimately decide whether or not this team is a playoff team. Like, I know I'm nuts and I think of things in different ways, but they won the season series from Seattle. They get the tiebreaker. Like, that's over. Yeah. It's done. You know, when I'm looking around at the out-of-town scores, especially in interleague play, obviously, which there is all the time right now, like, root for the random National League team to beat the random American League team on the random night, because that's the kind of stuff that could matter. But I'm with you. There, you know, of the 15 teams in the league, even if we give the Yankees and Tigers a pass, and put those two up top, and if we put the other four we talked about, Orioles, White Sox, Angels, A's at the bottom, now you're left with nine, and four of those are going to make the playoffs. And one of them is coming from the West, obviously, the division champ. So the Blue Jays are in the mix. They're in, as I've called it a couple times, they're in the big mushy middle in the American League right now. It's not great. Like, you know, I think the average Blue Jay fan even though they're a game over 500, is probably, if you said, describe how you feel the Blue Jays have played in the first 49 games, I bet you you'd get a lot of disappointed, underachieving, here we go again. You know what I mean? Even though they're 25 and 24, but they haven't buried themselves. There's 113 games left, and they haven't buried themselves. And I think they're finding out, I think they have found more solutions to their problems than new problems in the first 49 games, if that makes sense.
That does.
You know, Bowden Francis has to be a bit of a concern. What are they going to do with the fifth spot? Is Hoffman okay? Which I think he is, but I know a lot of people are worried about that. Is Santander? You know, those are concerns. But I think they have found more solutions than fresh concerns in the first 49 games. And whether it's a Scherzer, a Swanson, a Sandlin, a Turnbull, a Roden. Like, I think there's also a little bit more depth and a few more possibilities to plug holes than maybe we thought there, you know, there would be 6-8 weeks ago. So all in all, I think they're doing okay. They're keeping their heads above water. But you know what? Can't get swept here by the Rays. Like, got to take 2 out of 3 from the Rays. They're behind you in the standings. Keep them behind you in the standings. You're facing DeGrom and Eovaldi Monday and Tuesday. Like, got to play well against the Rays because that Texas series is going to be tough.
Yeah. No, I think that's really well said. The more solutions than problems thing. And yeah, RIP My Athletics, who I think have lost 10 in a row, somewhere close to that. I was like a little optimistic about them. If you ask Ben Nicholson Smith, the team that I've texted him the most about is the A's, because I'm like, yeah, they got like, there's a lot of young guys on this team I like. I like the top of their order. I like D-Law. I like Young. I like Rooker. I was, you know, the Soderstrom thing felt real. Their pitching staff, you know, Mason Miller at the back. I was like, oh, maybe this is they're still the A's. I also think that there's something to the Rays and the A's where I'm like writing them off because of the ballparks they play in, like that they won't be able to take the season seriously enough. Yeah, I don't know how many Rays games you're watching, but when they're at home, it's depressing. Like, it's
well, that's where I'm going to be tonight, right? So I'll get a firsthand look at it. Kevin Cash
enjoy
about it last week. Yeah, and we expect a rain delay during batting practice. Apparently, that's almost a given. It's going to be smoking hot. Nobody is happy. Like, you talk to 10 people, 5 say the wind is blowing out. It's not fair to pitchers. 5 say, well, the wind blows in a lot and the lighting's bad, so the hitters can't see the ball. Like, nobody's happy right now. And the best thing for the Blue Jays is if the Rays are unhappy with their home ballpark. One thing I thought the Blue Jays did well in 2021, and we haven't said his name in a long time, but I'm going to give Charlie Montoyo some credit. Very, very rarely did you hear Blue Jays complaining about the Dunedin Buffalo stuff. Very, very rarely. I've heard more complaining from the Rays this year than we ever heard from the Blue Jays in 2021. The Rays are 13-18 at home, 10-8 on the road. Now, again, that could all change, but they don't appear to be too happy. We'll see how the Blue Jays feel. Apparently, whether it's Major League Baseball or the Yankees, the Rays, like I think everybody kind of got together and put a lot of money into the place and the facilities, like the stuff we don't see, clubhouses and weight rooms and hitting cages and batting cages. I think all that stuff's pretty good, but we'll see what it plays like. Two night games and a day game. Tomorrow should be a day game, but it's a night game to try to avoid the heat and the rain. So we'll see how the Blue Jays handle it. Like, just about everybody would have played in this park coming up, either in spring training or in A-ball, but hopefully the Blue Jays can adjust to it well this weekend.
Well, yeah, they definitely, every single Rays broadcast I've seen, they complain about the fact that there's no seats in the outfield, right? And so the wind impacts the game far more than it does in a normal stadium.
Yep.
So you're right. One night it's like you hit a little joke ball to right field and it's gone because it carries like a foot. And it's like, oh, wait, that looked like a can of corn and it's over the fence. And then you're right. Other nights it's blowing around and guys are unable to pick up fly balls. It doesn't look good. I don't feel good about the Rays long term. I actually, when I see their team, I'm like, well, you got a couple good starting pitchers and the bullpen's not a disaster. Like, there's a couple guys at the back end that are decent and there's Blue Jay killers in their lineup all over the place. So you're like, oh, wait, how are they not better? And they've still got that versatility that the Rays carry, but yeah, there is just something about when you watch him, it feels so AAA, so like major leagues, Cleveland, where you're like, yeah, this doesn't feel like a serious baseball team. This feels like they're trying to run the group out of town. That I just don't buy it. Okay, so a couple of the negatives. Well, or maybe not, but we'll see how you feel about them. I'm not really worried about Hoffman. I think this is more of a case of, hey, he was so incredible to start that seeing him give up any runs is just like, what is happening here? But there's at least a little bit. He's given up a few homers and he's blown a couple of these saves. Where are you at with what's happened with Hoffman lately?
Not overly concerned. I think it's mostly pitch selection. I don't think he's hurt. I don't think he's tired. I think he has missed some spots. And I think a couple of them, whether it's to me, the biggest problem has been the walk preceding the big hit, which has happened in three of his outings. I think sometimes he could use his fastball a little bit more. I'm going to ask today, but I think sometimes if they see a guy has really good numbers on a fastball, he shies away from his fastball a little bit. And listen, his slider's good. His splitter can be really good. The splitter's the one that Gavin Sheets got yesterday. And it wasn't a horribly located pitch. It was down near the knees. But it almost feels to me like guys know, hey, if I'm a good fastball hitter, he knows that. I might sit on something else because he's not throwing his fastball as much to guys who are hitting fastballs well. I may be totally wrong in that, but I'll ask around today. I think it's a little bit of pitch selection and a little bit of pitch location. I think it's fixable. I think sometimes, you know, as the saying goes, the other guys drive nice cars too, right? Sometimes you get beat. Yeah. And, Gavin Sheets, pretty good player. Jorge Soler's pretty good player. Yoan Moncada hit one out. Like, these guys are all capable major league players, but I think he's going to be fine. And on top of that, you know, if they needed to, and I'm not saying they should or would, but you got Jimmy Garcia, you got Yariel Rodriguez now. Like, you've got this bullpen is really good at the moment with the way the two lefties are doing. And I know it was a little bumpy for a little yesterday, but the way the two lefties are doing, the improvement of Yariel Rodriguez, which to me has been one of the biggest developments on the team. The fact that they can use him in leverage and the fact that they can use him more than an inning. That's really big. I think the bullpen is fine. If you know, I think the four and we'll see about the five spots in the rotation are things to, you know, if you like to worry, you know, you can worry about those and Santander and stuff like that. But I think the bullpen's going to be fine, is fine. And I think Jeff Hoffman's going to be fine.
Yeah, I don't like to worry.
I didn't mean you specifically.
Yeah, I know, but I think that all of us who worry, it's not what we like to, but I would consider myself to be a worrier.
The
Bowden Francis thing, I'm having a tough time with it just because he's just given up too many home runs. And yeah, like, again, I would reference you during the broadcast earlier in the season where it was like you and Buck having this conversation, like, everywhere we go, people ask us, how is he getting people out? It's a mystery around baseball, how he's doing so well, and now he's not. And I'm like, well, maybe because he's not good. So that's a bit of a problem. But at least you're right. Again, I don't know what the timeline is on Scherzer or how reliable that should be. I don't know when they're going to get Manoah back, but at least on his Instagram, I'm seeing him throw baseballs instead of just lift weights, which is encouraging to me. Like, okay. Yeah. That's
well,
something.
I'll give you some timelines if you want. They're general, but Spencer Turnbull would be the closest option, I think, if things go well. So I think he's in Dunedin. But he's got, they signed him to a major league deal with the agreement that he would spend a certain number of days in the minors ramping up. If all goes well, I think he's in Toronto in 3 weeks, maybe less, in about 3 weeks probably. Yeah. So, you know, maybe four turns of the rotation from now. Scherzer's not that close. Like, Scherzer is still side sessions. Next would be live hitters BP. Next would be rehab, and then would be back. So, like, I wouldn't think Scherzer's less than a month. No way, no how. So Turnbull would be first. If it goes well, then Scherzer. The target date I've heard for Manoah, if all goes well, is August 1st. So trade deadline-ish. So for the next, say, four times through, I think you're looking at Bowden Francis, Eric Lauer in those two spots, and you see how they do. You know, could they go get an Easton Lucas again if they wanted, you know, if they wanted to flip it up?
No, thank you.
They could. But the one thing I think they want to do and need to try to find a way to do, and it's hard, but is separating Bowden Francis and the fifth spot, because those are likely to be the two starts out of five where you're getting the fewest innings, which means the bullpen's getting taxed a lot like it did yesterday. And they didn't know it would go 11 innings, but they knew when they took him out after four, they would need five innings out of the bullpen heading into an Eric Lauer start. And Eric Lauer could go out and give him five or six great innings. He's been good. But
yeah,
they've got to let him go five or six innings today because of what happened yesterday.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point about the taxation on the bullpen. And it's why I was down at the last Eric Lauer start. And he pitched great, right? He had a really good performance. I think he ended up pitching only four, though. It was three.
Where they used the whole bullpen. Yariel came in for the fourth and fifth, and then they kind of left, right. He only pitched three in that. That was the Tigers game. They, you know, Torkelson homered off him the first time, and they didn't want to let him get to Torkelson the second time. And, you know, they knew they had multiple. The bullpen was really rested heading into that game. It was good. And it all worked out well. But it's great when it works, but you can't keep doing it Francis start and every Lauer game. It's just too much on the bullpen.
So that is definitely a concern, especially given those timelines that it's like, yeah, you got to do another month of Bowden Francis. It's like, oof. Or like another month of three innings from a starter. And granted, I do think that was a specific scenario with, like you just outlined, with the Tigers and how dangerous they are and how much they were trying to get that win. And it did work out. So, yeah. The thing that is sticking with me right now, more than probably anything, is how little I'm missing Santander when he's not playing or Andreas Giménez. And I don't think that like the guys that are replacing them are necessarily better players, but, and I know that it's what, May 22nd, 23rd that we're in that range, late May. I'm bad with dates. It's somewhere in there. I don't miss the two guys that got the most money in the off season. And I don't know how to feel about that.
Fair, but I think they're going to be needed. Like they may not have, obviously they haven't contributed as much as we would have wanted them to this point, but they're going to be needed. They need Santander's power. Like Barsho is not going to hit 70 home runs this year.
Barsho number one fan. You're out.
They need Santander's power. They need him to get hot. And even if it's 230, but can he hit 20 some home runs between now and the end of the season and, you know, help them in that department. And I think that also, you know, quietly, George Springer's cooled off a lot in the last couple of weeks too. Another reason why you need Santander, and Springer could get hot again. We've seen hot, cold from him, but Giménez to me is interesting. Elite defense, elite base running, but wasn't hitting much at all. And John Schneider was asked yesterday, we talked about it on the broadcast. I don't know if you saw that part, but you know, what happens when he comes back? And let's say it's 7 to 10 days until he's back, because Barger has made a big, loud statement in the last little while. And I think the guy it's going to impact is Ernie Clement. And it'll impact all three of them. But I think against righties, you are likely to see Barger at third, Giménez at second. Against a lefty, one of them sits and Clement starts. And Ernie could start against a righty. Do they want their best defense on the field with a ground ball pitcher? Maybe Ernie gets a spot start at third. Does Bo DH or get a day off? Ernie plays short. Ernie's now the backup first baseman, which he wasn't at the beginning of the year either. But so I think there's a little more playing time than just against lefties. And he could also pinch hit. He could pinch run. He could come in for defense. But I think Clement is going to be impacted by all three of them will be impacted. I don't think any of the three of them are playing every day. But I think this is what you're looking at. And if you look at Clement's numbers, and I'm not looking at them right at the moment, but last year and this year, hits lefties better than righties. So you're putting him in favorable spots. It's good for them that Clement's a right-handed batter. You sit either Barger or Giménez against a lefty. And again, they never face lefties. It's been like 2.5 weeks, but that'll change. But I think it has a chance to put all three of those guys in favorable matchups where they can sit down every day and say, okay, who gives them the best chance to win today? So now at the end of the day, Giménez has to hit a little bit more than he has hit. He's not, you know, I don't think anybody's expecting 2022 Andrés Giménez, but again, can he just hit for a decent average, you know, pop a home run once a month and then do some great base running and play some great defense? We know there's value there. And if, you know, Lucas and Barger and Kirk and those guys are all hitting well, then you can live with Giménez not hitting as well, right? Because you don't need – he's going to probably be the 8 or the 9 hitter. If other guys are hitting well, you can live with a little bit less offense from him a little bit easier.
Dan, I did hear it. If I'm not at the ballpark, I'm listening.
All right.
I have muted many a play-by-play team or broadcast team. I've thrown the odd mute on, play something in the background, like, yes, or – put a second screen and run the volume on that. I've never done that to you guys. So yeah,
I appreciate that. And if you do it, not something you should say out loud, probably.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. Don't worry. Whoever I've done that to, I'll tell them, I'll be like, I would say the exact same thing I just told you, except for it would be a lie and not the truth. Hey man, I kept you too long, but thanks so much for doing this. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Dan.
All right. You got it. See you.
See you, man. Dan Shulman, voice of the Blue Jays. Okay. Here's My prevailing thoughts are this. Again, it's a hot streak for Varsho and Kirk, but those two guys, while I don't think Varsho is going to, as Dan put it, hit 70 home runs, I'm very optimistic that the power numbers go up. He's not a hitter for average. I get it. There's going to be matchups, the lefty on lefty stuff, where he's going to not look so great. The defense already has him as such a high floor player in general, and the base running and the IQ, all those different things that we've already come to know about Dalton Varsho. But when they did trade for him, that was what was making the trade so disappointing in year one, is that he wasn't hitting for that power. You were like, hey, he started the season in a four hole. This guy was supposed to be the cleanup hitter, and then you were watching him and was like, this isn't a cleanup hitter. And I don't think that's what he should be. I kind of like what he's been right now with the baseball team. And again, I know he's extremely hot, but I'm buying the power uptick. The Kirk stuff to me feels very real. This is vintage Kirk, not again, all of the power from the very beginning. I don't think we're going to see him ever be the DH like we did in seasons prior. There are questions about how he's going to hold up. He's a catcher after all. I was talking about with Ennis earlier this week, like these guys wear down, their careers end way before you expect them to. And it might be too much, but so far he looks great. And when he gets up to the plate, Dan said it, He's hitting the ball hard. He's hitting line drives. He's working counts. Just love his approach. Those two guys, the formula remains true from the very beginning of the season. Springer's gone cold. They've had no Santander. Whatever. You need the top guys to be doing their thing. And then can you get a couple of guys that get hot for a month? And that is what's been going on, except for more guys have gotten hot this month. But, okay, so Santander's a different story. I know he's going to hit home runs. I don't think he's going to be as bad as he has been to start, which has been brutal. Like, it really has been. It's been tough. It was encouraging that he hit that bad pitch out of the park the other day, because that's what I expect him to do. That's what a power hitter is supposed to do. Oh, you hung one? Goodbye. So he's going to have purpose in this lineup. He just is. As a DH, as the odd time in the field, whatever, you're going to need his power, like Dan said. The guy that I'm having a tougher time with is Jimenez, because Ernie Clement has been fine. Addison Barger is promising. No, I don't care for losing starts to, like, I'd rather have Andreas Jimenez, obviously, than Stefanik. But here's what I just don't think changes for me. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. But as of right now, just telling you how I feel, hard to envision all the money that's coming Andreas Jimenez's way is going to feel worth it. This is the thing. It shouldn't be missed. Is Andreas Jimenez better than the last man on the roster right now? Okay, sure. But he's making a lot of money. And yeah, it's no salary cap, and you don't worry about this as much as, say, the Leafs, where it's a hard cap and it definitively impacts you. But it's, yeah. And it doesn't, you can't really criticize it until you find out that, like, maybe it prevented you from doing something, which I don't think that is the case. But overall, you still want to feel like you're getting good value out of a player. And part of the Jimenez trade that people, the way they evaluated it around baseball was, well, Cleveland made this move because they didn't feel as though they'd be able to get off that money a year later if he had another offensive season like the one he just had in Cleveland. And that's the type of season he's having here in Toronto. So it's good. It's good. It's good that they're playing this way right now, basically without those two guys, because Santander was in and out of the lineup, and then the hips bothering him. So you give him the benefit of the doubt that he's not fully healthy. But Jimenez, yeah. I have a tough time seeing how it's going to end up being worth it. That's all. Anyway, subscribe to this podcast, leave 5 stars. You can reach out to me anytime on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. So I got a lot of messages yesterday on Twitter and on Instagram about the topic that I'm going to do after the break. I tweeted about it. I got a lot of replies, a lot of which were quite discouraging. And I had so many people DM me that there's going to be a lot of people that are out there going, oh, I was the person that sent him this. And it's like, no. There were many of you that sent this. And to me, it has become one of the most predictable Toronto takes. And frankly, one of the most infuriating. That's next. So I really thought this year was different for a lot of different reasons. And the end was familiar. The Leafs choked, played poorly, froze, tensed up, however it is that you're selling it to yourself. In big moments, Game 5 and Game 7. And some people have laid the blame more of the blame pie in different corners. But overall, it really did feel like the consensus here has been, well, okay, it's been a long time and it's been a lot of these style of exits. So something's got to change. And quickly, there's been a lot of Marner discourse, obviously, because he's a pending free agent and Tavares clearly wants to be back. And I do think that's missed in the conversation here a little bit, like tying back to the stuff I was saying about Shanahan earlier, which is, one, Marner has the control. So whenever people are doing these, well, wouldn't you take Marner back at this? It's like, okay, yeah, but that's not what it is. Basically, the Leafs tried to feel him out. Maybe no official contract was tendered, but on an 8-year deal at 13 per season. And they didn't want to do that. That's why he was asked to waive the no move, or whether he would waive the no move. So as things have gotten worse, I don't understand why things would materially change for Marner unless there was really no destination that he viewed in free agency that was appealing to him. And Toronto was still willing to offer that kind of money, which I think we've come to the conclusion that it doesn't make sense having those guys all together on that kind of money. Not that Marner is a bad player. It's about the fit with your team from a salary standpoint. But what was so frustrating about the end of the Shanahan era is, like, because you created such a deep coddle culture with Dubas as well, where you allowed these no-move contracts and you never acted after other failures, that it got to the point where you're losing a guy like that without recouping any assets. The argument used to be, well, you can't trade Marner because you'll never get enough talent back in the trade. It's like, well, it's better than having him walk, which looks like the realistic scenario here. So when people say this to me, I lose my mind. And I saw it yesterday in mass. And I hand up, I'm sure I've done it many times where it's a straw man argument. I find that to be frustrating when you see it. It's like the Magic Johnson take, right? You're like, come on. And I'm sure I've fallen for these kind of things too, or overemphasized an opinion like this. So I tweeted it yesterday, and you can go read the replies. There's some of them are public to you. It's not all just the DMs. Again, at JD Bunkus, anytime. The Panthers look really good because they are really good. And they're beating the brakes off of the meek Carolina Hurricanes, who are just a different form of loser like the Leafs. They get to a conference finals, and then they're like, oh, no more wins. See tu. They stink. The Leafs would have probably beaten them. I deeply believe that. It's what actually adds to the frustration of the way that they played in Game 5 and Game 7, because what they had in front of them was so ridiculously tantalizing. It was open. It was there for them. They didn't do it. Again. Because the formula didn't look great. And yes, there's the bottom six didn't play great. Yeah, yeah. Again, you don't build these great bottom sixes when you're spending so much at the top. Like, all these things are tied together. But I've seen this take of what I think is, again, the most predictable thing in Toronto sports, which is when the Leafs lose, the team that beats them goes and plays well. It's either Tampa or Montreal making their cup run, or now the Florida Panthers, who also did this to Toronto in 5 games a couple of years ago. So it's like multiple variations of the exact same thing where people go, well, look how these guys are playing and the Leafs took them to seven. So are we sure the Leafs are bad? No, the Leafs aren't bad. They're just not great. And I had some people were reaching out going, can you believe that MLSE said the goal was to win in the, to get to the Eastern Conference Final? It's like, again, that was the floor, not the ceiling, but whatever. The goal is to win championships. You're going to play a great team in the playoffs at some point. Likely. Sometimes it breaks your way where it's like the Oklahoma City Thunder getting a Denver team with two players with, you know, one arm and one leg. Or the way it broke for Minnesota getting to the Western Conference Finals where they played complete nobody teams. But ultimately, at some point, you're going to play a good opponent. And in the postseason, it's just the math. It's the easiest math. I suck at math, but we should be able to understand that if you even get beaten the first round of the playoffs, there's only four teams advancing, including the team that beat you. It's very likely that they're a good team because they're in the playoffs, and it's likely that they will go on a run because there's only four teams left in the conference. Like, what your eyes have told you year over year over year should not change because of the things that you see in the following round, because somebody else looks like they stink or somebody else looks like they're worse than the Leafs. And that the formula is, well, if the dominoes fall for you perfectly, if you never have to face the best team in the conference or the second best team in the conference, then you could win. It's like, come on. We got to stop with this. We got to stop with this take. Anyways. And I've already heard all the opinions on it, so you can reach out, but I guarantee you I've already seen what the case is. Anyway, quick break, come back. What are we going to expect today from the Pelly press conference? What happens next with David Pagnotta and then Zach Harper on his T-Wolves, and which of us is feeling more pain? That's the next hour.